I think you can tell if you have read Janet's bio that she's a person of a lot of experience in the field that she's going to be talking about. And I don't remember how we first connected.
I contacted you because I wanted to interview you.
The interview, yeah. She was writing her book, and she contacted me, and she had information, I think, about my daughter. Also, I told her, I can't remember. I told her I'd be more than willing to talk to her, but at that point in my life, I didn't want my name used. Kathleen was much braver than me, and there are some quotes from her in the book. But it's a fabulous book, and there's just so much material in it. And Janet is, you know, a real expert in various forms of the subject she's going to talk about. So with no further time, I'll turn the time over to her, and she will take the time that we designated her. So we will be going to lunch about a half hour later.
Thank you, Sue. Appreciate it. Thanks. I think I'm good. Well, thank you all for having me. I'm going to be talking about some sensitive issues, some difficult issues, and this might be the first time that I've talked to a group where many people out there might very well be survivors of religious child abuse and neglect. So I wanted to let you know that if anyone does feel at all triggered or especially anxious or something like that, feel free to just put your hand up. I won't call on you because it won't be part of the Q&A, but I'll certainly kind of move on. I don't want this to be a distressing or unsafe kind of environment. As Sue said, I've been researching this for a pretty long time. I started in 2008. I really came across the topic like I was with any underreported important issue that I felt I needed to cover as a journalist. I had been reporting for National Public Radio and writing investigative articles and that kind of thing. I personally didn't grow up with a lot of religion in my background, and if you do read my book, you'll learn a little bit about my upbringing. But I really come at this topic as a journalist. For the good and for the bad. I mean, I can't speak personally. On the other hand, I feel like I'm probably able to look at certain aspects of it in a fairly clear way. I want to thank you all for having me last night at the open mic. That was really special time for me, and it was really valuable to get to know folks better. You know, it could have been kept as this private thing where, you know, outsiders who aren't survivors or, you know, have not grown up or been exposed to the LDS Church, you know, could have been kept out. And I really appreciated being part of that. And I also want to thank Sue, of course, for having me, but both her and Kathleen for agreeing to talk to me when I was looking for interview victims. They really provided valuable information, and you might hear a little bit about what I gleaned from our talks. This is a question that I often get asked, and I often pose to people: is religion good or bad for kids? Certainly, different people have different ways of answering that, oftentimes based on how they grew up. I think that, empirically speaking, studies show that it really can go either way. There are studies that show that kids that are raised in a religious environment are better behaved, learn better, have more self-control than kids that are raised in secular households. Victor Veith is a forensic expert. He used to be a prosecutor, and he speaks about this topic a lot in terms of religious influences on children. And he says that spirituality is an intrinsic part of human development and may be particularly important to vulnerable children. I had interviewed dozens of people for Breaking Their Will, my book, and I found that even individuals who are raised with really quite horrific circumstances still had some good things to say about how they were raised. I was talking to this young man who had left the FLDS and was dealing with all the difficulties of being on the outside. But he told me, being part of that community as a kid was pretty great sometimes, and he felt very safe, and any family, in his area would, welcome him in if he needed anything. So, he really liked the community aspect of it. But religion also has a dark side. And while there are many well-meaning, compassionate people in religious organizations, we also have to acknowledge that a religious upbringing does not always enrich a child's well-being. Just as religiosity can help people to treat children better, it can also lead people to mistreat children, sometimes permanently harm them, and even fatally. While studies do show that children raised in faith might be better behaved, we know little really about how it affects their well-being, their self-esteem. I personally am not a big proponent of child obedience, as the mantra of parenting. I have a chapter in my book called An Obsession with Child Obedience, which I find to be present in certain aspects of just about every religion that I've studied. There's one study that came out this year that showed that 5 and 6-year-olds who were raised in religious households had a difficult time differentiating between fantasy and reality compared to kids who were raised in secular households. And it gets worse. Marcy Hamilton, who's a professor at Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University, writes in her book God Versus the Gavel, "Horrible things have been done to children beneath the cloak of religion. Children have been raped, beaten, and permitted to die excruciating deaths." So, what is religious child maltreatment? It's child abuse or neglect that is enabled by religious beliefs held by perpetrators, victims, or their surrounding community. I'm going to repeat that. Religious child maltreatment is child abuse or neglect that is enabled by religious beliefs held by perpetrators, victims, or the surrounding community. And here are some fairly current examples. Earlier this year, a mother and father from Wisconsin were sentenced to 18 months of probation for physically abusing their children. The couple was the last of a handful of parents who belonged to the Aletheia Bible Church, who were members of the Aletheia Bible Church, to be found guilty of harming their children through excessive corporal punishment. The church was led by this man, Philip Caminiti, who was sentenced to 2 years in prison for conspiracy to commit child abuse after he instructed congregants to punish, quote, selfish children as young as infants and toddlers by striking them on the bare buttocks with wooden dowels based on his interpretation of Proverbs in the Old Testament, which tells parents to use, quote, the rod to discipline children. We've heard plenty about religious organizations, clergy specifically, not reporting child sexual abuse. That is a form of neglect. The video you're about to see shows a rabbi being told by a man that he had been sexually abused when he was a child. As often happens, the rabbi, who admits he knows who the perpetrator is, and by the way, this is all done with a hidden camera, tells the man not to tell the authorities. He'll give as his justification Masira, which is a Jewish law that forbids Jews from saying bad things about other Jews to outsiders. The rabbi, who is a powerful man in the UK, shows shows about as much compassion and empathy for this man, you know, as if he came in and said, you know, I need to dump your trash. It's really mind-boggling to me just how uncaring this man is when he's told this information.
I've come to you, to be honest, about a very delicate issue. Someone who did bad things to me when I was younger. Someone who you may know of. Who abused me, sexually abused me when I was younger, when I was a child. And I'm looking for your advice, to be honest, what to do. I think it's someone you might have dealt with in the past. I think it's someone you might have dealt with in the past.
I imagine I know whom we are talking. And if I'm correct, we are dealing with it. So
how is it being dealt with? Are you involved in it with him? Mm. Are you involved in it, in dealing with it?
I was involved, but...
Would you think maybe... Is it a good idea to speak to the police about it? No? Why?
It's a serious...
But this is a very serious issue.
Yes, but not...
Not the police.
Nice guy. This couple is Herbert and Catherine Scheibel, Pennsylvania. Earlier this year, they were sentenced up to 7 years in prison for allowing their 8-month-old child, Brandon, to die of pneumonia. The Scheibels belonged to the Pentecostal Christian Church that believes, a Pentecostal Christian Church, that believes in faith healing over modern medicine. So when Brandon got sick, they refused to take him to a doctor and instead treated him with prayer. Remarkably, Brandon was not the first in the family to die of religious medical neglect. In 2009, the Scheibel son, Kent, died at the age of 2, also from untreated pneumonia. They were given 7 years in prison. However, in the first case, it was a mere slap on the wrist. And in a lot of these cases, parents who are on trial for allowing their children to die of religious medical neglect often gain a lot of sympathy from the jury, and they're given, you know, hardly any kind of punishment whatsoever. But because this was the second death in the family, they were a little bit harsher. We talked a lot. I heard last night from a lot of people instances of what I would consider to be religious, emotional, or psychological abuse or neglect. And this comes in many forms. I think it's the most pervasive form of religious child maltreatment. These cases rarely make headlines. You won't see CPS coming in and removing a child when the maltreatment is simply psychological. But I do think that this form of maltreatment exists in every case. You can't really have a case of sexual abuse, physical abuse, or other forms of maltreatment, including medical neglect, you know, and not have there be a pretty serious psychological effect going on. I talk in the book about various forms of child maltreatment, including spurning, terrorizing, exploiting, and isolating. And I'll just talk about those a little bit. Spurning, as you can imagine, is when a child is told something that makes them feel worthless. Terrorizing, scaring a child. Isolating is when a child is kept under tight controls and not permitted to have close relationships with people who are considered to be apostates, who were non-believers. They're told and taught a very narrow worldview. And the last one is exploiting, which I didn't fully understand at first when I was trying to figure out just like what that means, what it looks like. One common way that children might be exploited is, you know, if they're violations of child labor laws. In this case, you see, you know, kids are, this is the second photo, by the way,
is a child who's made to hold a protest signs for the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas. And that church is notorious for protesting soldiers' funerals, and it's their way of expressing anger that America is so welcoming of homosexuals. But both of these forms, both of these photos show what I consider to be a form of religious exploiting, and it's when you live your life through a child, you live your faith through a child. You have a child having to, you know, pray for hours every night, sit in church services, on and on and on when it's not age appropriate for them. I wrote a blog post, and there was a woman named Amber who wrote a comment that I thought really illustrated both terrorizing and exploiting. This is what she said. A familiar statement I often heard in my youth was, "You better have your heart right with the Lord. You never know when Jesus is coming back." That statement scared the shh out of me. How do you know if your heart is right with the Lord? If I can't communicate with him or see him, how do I know if I was all good? I don't believe a young mind can truly comprehend faith. I don't know if I understand it now. Either way, the statement created a sense of inadequacy, confusion, but ultimately fear. I felt as though every person I loved was saved but me, so I tried very hard to please God. And more than one person I interviewed did talk about waking up and for different reasons. There was no one around when they woke up. Like, the house was dark. Everyone had left. One kid woke up from a nap, couldn't find anybody. And both of them were just stricken with fear because they thought the second coming had happened and everyone had left and not taken the child with them. And I want to read a quote from a young woman who grew up in the LDS church. Her name is Karis Hout. She was 25 when I interviewed her. I think this is an example of both isolating and exploiting. Karis told me that it was a huge sin in the church to learn about other faiths and read anti-Mormon material. She added, "They'll tell you be in the world, but don't be of the world," a phrase that relates to the book of John in the Bible. She added, "They don't want you to be friends with anyone that's not Mormon, or really close friends. They don't want you to adapt to the other person's lifestyle at all." And, excuse me, that's just isolating. Oh, no, excuse me, it is both exploiting and isolating. Sorry. You may not be aware of a Jewish ritual known as Mitzitzah B'Peh, which is practiced in ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities. In this ritual, which takes place after circumcision, the moel, or rabbi, puts his mouth on the penis and sucks blood from the wound. Mitzitzah B'Peh was started hundreds of years ago as a way to sanitize the wound. However, some rabbis have given herpes simplex 1 to these babies. It's a disease that a vast majority of the population has, and when infants come in contact with it, they can suffer brain damage and even death. Since 2000, 16 babies in New York City have contracted herpes after undergoing Mitzitzah B'Peh. Of those, 2 babies died and 2 were brain damaged. At the end of this month, I'll be speaking on a panel about in New York about that particular form of abuse. I'm often asked, are some religions better or worse than others? From my research, it really doesn't matter what the brand of religion is going on in the child's world. The family could be practicing, you know, a Christian-based faith, Islamic, Jewish. They could be worshiping a deity they call Jehovah, Yahweh, God, or Allah. Or whether they're reading from the Book of Mormon, the New Testament, or the Quran. Instead, it's important to look at how a child's culture and examine how the people who are caring for the child are being governed. I conclude that when a religious culture, is authoritarian, kids are at a particularly high risk for being victims of religious child maltreatment. I define a religious authoritarian culture as having three characteristics. The membership is under a strict social hierarchy. So religious leaders are the most powerful individuals in the environment. Men are almost always more powerful than women. And children have next to no rights whatsoever. The membership is unusually fearful. And this is often due to control tactics, terror tactics. They can manifest themselves in the way of shunning, excommunication, or just threats of those kinds of actions, as well as theological beliefs in terms of what might happen to apostates in the afterlife. Thirdly, the culture is socially separatist, and I have found without question that every religious authoritarian culture I've looked at, there is some form of social separatism. They may not necessarily be located out on a compound in West Texas, but there is that social separatism going on, even in urban environments. And this often is instilled in the membership from birth. So kids, for example, they may be going to public school, but they're told from a very young age that they should not get too close to outsiders. They may be taught to fear outsiders. And sometimes that includes people who are charged with protecting children from abuse, like CPS, police, doctors, and others. How does a religious authoritarian culture actually harm children? To understand this, it's important to look at how parents are affected, or children's guardians. Parents are, or are supposed to be, the protectors of kids. They're often not perfect. Sometimes I, as a mother, don't always make the best decision, but you know, I do the best I can, often by reading about parenting and child psychology, things like that. And just, you know, talking with my child and trying to understand her needs better. But when it comes down to it, you know, I am greatly responsible for her safety and well-being. And in religious authoritarian cultures, parents operate very differently. They're called, what cult experts would say, are middle managers. That is, these are parents that don't have the same kind of autonomy in making child-rearing decisions as I might enjoy. Oftentimes, middle manager parents are torn between their natural instinct to care for their children and complying with regulations and rules set by the religious leadership. The ultimate result is that children cannot look to their parents for protection, and so therefore they're left extremely vulnerable. Middle manager parents have been around a very long time. Most people, religious or not, are familiar with the story of Abraham and Isaac. It's one of the most important stories in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. In the Old Testament version, God tells Abraham to sacrifice his son, Isaac. Abraham agrees. He takes Isaac up to Mount Moriah, ties him to the wood pile, and he gets ready to cut his throat. God sends a messenger to tell Abraham that he doesn't have to go through with it because God realizes that Abraham fears him. I think of Abraham as the ultimate middle manager parent. Most people who talk about the story don't describe Abraham's decision as being an easy one. Rather, it's assumed that he agonized over whether or not he should do what God wanted him to do. But in the end, he did what he believed his deity commanded, a decision that could have led to his son's death. So how do religious authoritarian cultures produce middle manager parents? Quite simply, really, the religious leadership doesn't trust parents to make decisions for their kids fully. So instead, they institute a lot of rules and tell families how they should operate. Clergy dictate these rules overtly or subtly. The community often all becomes part of the system. And so there's a lot going on where people are feeling obligated to go along with the rules, not just because, you know, their pastor or their rabbi or their imam tells them to, but because they know that if they don't go along with it, they're going to be ostracized in some way, maybe subtly, by the other members of the organization. When religious leaders might talk about the importance of strong families, but really what they're interested in is obedient families. In religious authoritarian cultures, religious leaders are more interested in weakening parent-child bonds, weakening families, because they're easier to control that way. Again, we can go back to the Bible to see examples of this. And I think it's important to point out that in the New Testament, there are passages that indicate that Jesus opposed religious authoritarianism. In Luke 22, he warns his people not to exercise authority over others. He says, "The greatest among you should become like the youngest, and the one who leads should become like the one who serves." But there's another passage, specifically in Matthew 10, that has Jesus talking about religious governance in a very different way. And I'm not a theologian, and I certainly can't say that Jesus, in fact, said these words, but I can say that whoever was responsible for getting this passage in the New Testament really understood the concept of religious authoritarianism and what it does to families. He said, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword, for I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a man's enemies will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Here's a more modern example. When Carolyn Jessup left the FLDS with her 8 children, she said in a press interview describing what the community was like. And I think she really captured what a religious authoritarian community, how it operates and how it affects families. She said, "Everything you did was monitored and controlled, and everybody reported on everyone else. It was a police state. You were not allowed to make decisions in your life. I had no power over my life or the lives of my children. It was a terrible way to live." I mentioned before about the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas, which has children holding these protest signs. There was a great documentary about the group in which the filmmaker interviewed a set of parents who had recently kicked their 20-something daughter out of the house, and the church all agreed that she should be communicated from the community. She was seen as being disobedient. I think she got online and had a conversation with a boy or something like that. When this woman's name is Lauren Drain, and she's written a book about her experiences. When she was asked about her feelings about her parents' decision to kick her out, she said, "Some people lose their parents to cancer or car accidents or other things. I've lost my parents to a cult." I don't believe that her parents would have excommunicated Lauren had they been living in mainstream society. So even though maybe her dad may have gravitated toward that authoritarian lifestyle, he did actually become a convert in adulthood. I think we also have to look at the influences that parents are under in these cultures. Middle manager parents take on different forms. They can be perpetrators. For example, I mentioned before the young woman named Karis who grew up in the Mormon household, and she said as a child that she was terrorized by religious fears about sex and hell. Often the two were intertwined. When Karis was 5, she began to compulsively masturbate. Later, she came to believe that her behavior was prompted by anxieties from living with an abusive father. Karis's mother, on the other hand, when she discovered Karis's secret, instead of considering the possible psychological causes, she could only look at the problem as a theological one. This is how Karis described her conversation with her mother when her mother found out. "My mom sat me down and told me that was against the religion. She said, 'Masturbation is a huge sin. You can't go to temple if you do it. You just cannot do that in the religion.' She told me that you can go to hell and yell, got angry, and then had me clean the entire house. I'm talking vacuum, sweep, mop. I remember I was falling asleep cleaning the house as punishment. But as a kid, I just couldn't stop masturbating. It was just a compulsion for me. And as I was always getting into trouble to the point where I remember they actually openly started talking about it at church. When I was maybe 9, 10, 11, they were talking about how this is a sin, and I would always sit there and think, I'm going to hell. Middle manager parents can also be victims. When I interviewed Kathleen, I'm going to quote you, Kathleen, I don't know if you're here. Okay, then I can do it, and she won't worry. She described what it was like growing up in a household where her parents were under great pressure to live the dutiful Mormon life, and that meant having many children and spending many hours working in the church. Her parents were tapped out. And Kathleen, too, experienced the same kind of pressures as a parent. Here's how she put it to me. All of us are taught our entire lives that our only goal in life is to become mothers and fathers in Zion. And we are taught that we must raise our children to be with us in the celestial kingdom, the highest level in heaven. And if your children stray, you're a failure as a parent, let alone your eternal family circle is broken. It is entirely your fault if your children stray. Therefore, there is not any reason to raise your children with any sort of critical thinking skills. Obedience is the only answer to stay together forever. There is no other goal in life than to make it into the celestial kingdom, and only there will we be with our families for eternity. I'm going to play a video. It's short. It is a difficult one. It's includes a series of interviews of a mother and daughter who were in this religious group called the Aggressive Christianity Missions Training Corps. This group started in the early 80s, and it had this like militaristic style to it. You'll see when you see a video of one of the cult leaders, she's wearing a military uniform, and you'll see a photo of a member who's wearing one as well. So this was their theme. And this group was in just totalitarian. You know, it went beyond authoritarian. It was just as extreme as it can get. There was the mother that's interviewed here, whose name is Maura, along with some other members, later sued this church for abusive practices, and they won. But the church still operates. They're in New Mexico now. In the early 1980s, they got a house in Sacramento, California, and that's where they held their services, and that's where some of the members lived. So you will hear from the woman who sued the mother. Moore Schmier is her name, and her daughter is Rebecca. And when you're watching this, you'll see examples of religious terrorizing, exploiting, isolating, and physical abuse. Also, you should listen for how Rebecca, the daughter, describes how the cult leaders, the Greens, control the group by weakening family bonds.
There's a heaven and there's a hell. And there's going to be a lot of professing Christians in hell. There's going to be a lot of foolish children burning forever.
The Greens encouraged this sort of behavior because it made these children tougher. It made them warriors, made them more spiritual. The more parents abuse their children in front of the Greens, the better favor they wear in the Greens' eyes. My stepfather was very, very loyal to the Greens. He had a very close relationship with Lila, and he would do anything that they asked. He was probably the most obedient person in there. I would watch him insult my mother. I'd watch him get on my mother's case. I'd watch him treat my mother badly. And this was okay because he was in with the Greens. And I remember one time that I heard Steve tell my mother that she needed to whip my youngest brother because he was making noise. I needed to take him outside and spank him with a bare butt with a leather belt because he was cooing and making cute noises during their service. I spanked my children with a belt. And then I would cry when I, you know, after the event would happen. And if I didn't cry outwardly, I cried inwardly because part of my survival was learning not to cry. I witnessed a lot of abuse going on in the group. One of the parents in there used to drill her son and make him stand up and sit down for 30 minutes at a time. And he had to obey. And he was little. He was about 2.5. And when he didn't listen, he was beaten. They would lock him in the basement for days at a time and slip food under the door. One member of the group beat him with a board that had nails. He would cry out to God and pray to God loudly so everyone could hear him while he was locked up, yet no one would ever acknowledge him. The way the Greens work ultimately is that they want to break every bond that every family member has with each other, mother and child, husband and wife. It doesn't matter. It just, if they sense a bond there, they're going to break it.
Middle manager parents often can be enablers. And Karis was telling me that in addition to all the emotional issues she had to deal with, when she was getting ready for baptism, when she was close to 8 years old, a missionary came to the house, and he was molesting her. Another missionary had been molesting her older sister, and all this was going on in front of the parents. I mean, she describes, you know, how this guy was able to do this, touching her inappropriately and things like that. And the parents were like, they were just kind of blind to it. So I kind of saw them as enablers or bystanders. And I think it's really important. I run this nonprofit organization where we teach faith communities about religious child maltreatment and that kind of thing. And one thing that we're trying to get across is that if someone suspects that abuse or neglect might be happening, it's not enough to just kind of question, well, I don't have enough proof, or, you know, and come up with all kinds of reasons as to why, you know, they're not going to alert authorities. And I'm not talking religious authorities. I know the Mormon Church has an 800 number you can call. No, that's not reporting abuse and neglect, because the person on the other end of the line is someone with the LDS Church. I have seen this to be a consistent problem in religious organizations. Even some of the most liberal ones, that where, you know, they do not want to get the word out that there might be problems of abuse and neglect. So what we're trying to do, and I'll talk about this a little bit more later, but is to help promote faith communities that are talking about abuse and neglect, you know, that we'll put them on our website and say, you know, these folks are great protectors of children. And why that's a benefit to them is that then they can draw new members who want to find a place that understands children's needs and doesn't just sort of do the minimum requirements that insurance companies tell them they have to do. So anyway, I'll get into that a little bit more later. But I just think it's important that, you know, there's something in between of being a victim and being a perpetrator, and that's being an enabler. There are many different risk factors that go along with child maltreatment, and I would like to add to that list religious and ideological beliefs. You would think that this would be a no-brainer for people to accept. Religion seems to be getting less and less popular in the United States. Nearly 20% of Americans are not affiliated with any religion. More than 25% of Americans have left the faith in which they were raised, and there's a few other stats there. We have religious authorities who are coming out and speaking on behalf of children and speaking out against religious organizations that are harming them. Princeton Theological Seminary professor Donald Capps writes in his book, The Child Song, "This is not a pleasant subject, especially for those of us who have deep personal attachments to the Christian faith. But we dare not avoid the subject, for the abuse of children in the name of religion may well be the most significant reason for why they leave the faith when they're old enough to do so. We must ask ourselves, who can blame them? Why should they not abandon the scene of their silent torment?" Now, Professor Capps is a pretty liberal guy, but we also have folks in more conservative circles who are speaking out about religious child maltreatment. Boz Chavigian is an evangelical Christian. He's also the grandson of the Reverend Billy Graham. He heads an organization called Grace, which investigates abuse in churches. And my organization, my nonprofit, is having a conference in December, and he's one of our keynote speakers. But he writes, "The heartbreaking reality is that the marginalization of survivors is all too common in the Christian community. Just like the priest and Levi in the parable of the Good Samaritan, we are often so quick to embrace rational excuses for why we walk away. When we do this, we marginalize the very lives that God sees as beautiful and infinitely valuable. We have precedent set by the Supreme Court. In 1944, they ruled in a case that involved a Jehovah's Witness mother who was wanting to take a child into town and pass out flyers for Jehovah's Witnesses. The court ruled against her, and in the ruling, they wrote, "The right to practice religion freely does not include liberty to expose the community or the child to ill health or death. Parents may be free to become martyrs themselves, but it does not follow that they are free to make martyrs of their children before they've reached the age of full and legal discretion when they can make that choice for themselves." I thought it was interesting that they talked about ill health or death. So they were really broadening it to other cases, not just, in that case, like a, you know, child labor law violation. They were talking about religious medical neglect. In 1989, the United Nations adopted the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and several passages speak to the need to allow children intellectual autonomy, which is highly frowned upon in religious authoritarian cultures. "The child shall have the right to freedom of expression," is in one passage. "The right of the child to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion" is something that states need to provide. And "the state shall protect the child against all forms of exploitation." I will talk a little bit more about the convention a little bit later. But even with experts talking about this issue and with so many high-profile cases making headlines, and courts sometimes ruling in favor of children's rights. For example, when Jehovah's Witness parents refuse to give their children a necessary blood transfusion, knowing that the child will die if the child doesn't get it, courts have stepped in and said, no, you have to give the child that blood transfusion. That's a very legalistic religious organization, as some of you may well be aware. But still, many people of faith have a hard time accepting that religion has this dichotomy, that it's both nurturing for children and also harmful for children. We should keep in mind that we're in a very religious country. I can read it here. More than 80% of people belong to one religion or another. I won't read all these, but 86% of Americans believe in God, a universal spirit, or a higher power. A lot of people who are strong believers have a very difficult time thinking that anything so terrible as child abuse could be connected to something that, you know, their faith, that they really are adhering to and really treasure. Some people just say, you know, religious organizations are not the problem. There's nothing systemically bad going on. We should just be looking at perpetrators. You know, they're mentally ill, they're sadistic, or they're misinterpreting doctrines, they're twisting scriptural passages. They don't really get it, you know. Well, I kind of debunk all of those things. For starters, when some people have gone to trial, a few cases they've been found to be incompetent, or they've been found guilty or innocent by reason of insanity. Very rarely, though. Most people that go to trial in cases of religious child maltreatment are, you know, they're justifying their actions up until the last minute, and they don't seem crazy. When it comes to this idea that, well, you know, people that whip their children because they want to do what Proverbs says and use the rod and that kind of thing, and they, you know, they think they're being very loyal, or fundamentalist polygamous sects that are spiritually marrying girls at a young age to much older men, and, you know, all of these doctrines that they will come up with, interpretations they'll come up with as a way to justify their actions. I don't really feel like I have a right to say, well, you're less of a Christian, or you're less of a Jew, or you're less of a Muslim. I mean, if someone is justifying their actions in some kind of religious context, to me, you know, they have the right to draw what they want to draw from it. I just don't think anyone has a monopoly on what constitutes, you know, a real believer. Then you have instances in which religious apologists blatantly promote abusive or neglectful behavior because they see it as a necessary way to protect religious freedoms. We've seen courts, legislatures, public officials literally put children's lives in peril based on this idea that we have to protect religious rights. And part of the cost for that might be a child getting ill or getting hurt or even dying. When this happens, I feel that children who were cared for by certain pious believers are denied the same rights as children who were raised in mainstream culture. So to me, it's a very uneven playing field. Some examples would be the Supreme Court ruling in 1972 that the Amish can take their children out of high school. It was filed in Wisconsin, where all children were required to get an education up to the age of 16, but because the Amish said that, based on their belief that, quote, salvation requires life in a church community separate and apart from the world and worldly influence, that's what their lawyers stated as their justification. The Supreme Court said, sure, if you're a child who's raised in an Amish culture, you're not required to be, you don't have that right to the same educational benefits. I told you about the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. This was signed by the United States under President Bill Clinton. It was on its way towards ratification. And in fact, much of the document was actually created by Americans in the federal government in the Reagan administration. They borrowed from concepts in the U.S. Constitution. But while every U.N. country with a functioning government has ratified the convention, the United States has not. The reason for that is because conservative groups rebelled against it, especially when George W. Bush became president. And they came up with various different reasons why they felt it would be harmful for the U.S. to ratify the convention. One of them was that they were afraid that it would limit parental autonomy and that it would lead to a ban on spanking children. I was reporting as a journalist in Texas when hundreds of FLDS children were removed from the compound. And while there's a lot of criticism as to how CPS handled the case, I certainly have plenty. At the time, the press and a lot of the public were just slamming CPS because they were saying that, you know, they were infringing on the FLDS's rights to worship the way they wanted to by removing the kids from the sect. In the end, CPS, you know, claimed to make a difference in the culture. They had girls and mothers taking classes in sexual abuse and parenting and that kind of thing. 11 men were criminally prosecuted. They all went to prison, some for very long sentences. Warren Jeffs went to prison for life for sexually abusing two girls. But CPS ended up returning all children except for one to the FLDS. One ended up going to a woman who was a former member. I mean, she still knew all the folks. So it really was, you know, no child was taken from the home and found a more appropriate home. I don't think you would find that happening in any kind of, regular sexual abuse case where the kids are sent back to the home just because the mother is taking some parenting classes. In fact, no mothers or fathers were denied custodial rights. So even all of the men that are in prison today and Warren Jeffs have full custodial rights over their children. I'm going to skip over this next one just because it's a lot to go through. I mentioned to you before about Mitzitza Bepeh, this circumcision ritual that takes place in ultra-Orthodox communities. And, you know, it's really shocking to people when they hear that this goes on. It was kept very much, very, very quiet up until the city of New York's health department came out with their study showing how many children had been damaged by it, how many newborns. It's an average of, I don't know, like a little more than one a year that we know of, you know, that has contracted herpes. Well, to this day, it's still legal in every state. And even though New York City did require Moyles to get a form signed by the parents saying, yes, we know it's being done, because rabbis were doing it without even consulting the parents. I mean, that's the whole middle manager thing and, you know, authoritarian thing going on there. Also, that form says that the parent understands that there are risks. Rabbis are pretty much ignoring that mandate. So really nothing's really changed. And you know, it really just comes down to the fact that this is happening in a religious setting. I mean, I don't think you would find in any other environment where a man can put his mouth on a baby's penis and not be carted off to jail. So we just see a real hypocrisy there, in my view. This is a gravestone in Idaho. It's a state, like many, that have religious exemptions when it comes to religious medical neglect, where parents whose children die from religious medical neglect due to extreme faith-healing beliefs avoid prosecution. This is a religious exemption that was put in place during the Nixon administration. He had some high-ranking officials who were Christian Scientists, and due to some maneuvering, I won't go into the details, it's in my book, just about every state adopted an exemption in their child abuse statutes saying that parents will not be prosecuted if certain circumstances are present. So Idaho, which is one of the most lenient states and is kind of overrun by this church group called the Followers of Christ, they have graveyards full of dead children who died from treatable conditions. They also are in Oregon, and that is one of the few states that has completely repealed that exemption. And that was because of all the deaths that were happening in the Followers of Christ. And I will say that even though they did eventually do the right thing, a big reason I feel that was able to pass is simply because the Christian Science Church chose not to lobby against it. Just one really, you know, out there example of what I'm talking about occurred in the early 1990s. In Lake City, Florida, there was this group called End Times Ministry that was moving in, and they were a zealous faith-healing church. The mayor of the town, Gerald T. Witt, was very angry with his constituents because they were not warmly welcoming this group, partly because they had heard that a baby in the group had died from an untreated nosebleed. And when he was interviewed by St. Petersburg Times, he said, "It's maybe necessary for some babies to die to maintain our religious freedoms. It may be the price we have to pay. Everything has a price." So I'd like to get an idea of how much time I have, because I want to leave time for Q&A, and I didn't want to... 15? Okay. I'm going to kind of breeze through the rest of this. I just want to let you know that I feel like, even though in my book I do present some solutions to this legislative solutions. I have like a whole list of questions that parents can ask themselves to determine whether or not they're raising their kids in a religious authoritarian culture. But I think that the real key comes down to faith communities getting educated about this. Now, this is not going to be the more authoritarian ones that will have anything to do with this plan, but my nonprofit, which is called the Child Friendly Faith Project, we have a curriculum that we're developing for faith communities. And again, the whole motivation there for them is, you know, they're losing members. And just like a lot of churches have been designated as being open and affirming to welcome LGBT members, we feel like we could start a similar movement where churches, synagogues, and mosques could be considered child-friendly faith communities. And then there might be lots of folks on the outside, perhaps parents who themselves dealt with some of these issues as children, who are wary of joining up with a place of worship, might be more inclined to join a child-friendly faith community. One thing that we're trying to do is just really just to get places of worship to ask more questions. When they're teaching, you know, for example, the story of Abraham and Isaac, you know, so much of the attention of that story is placed on Abraham and talking about, wow, was he a devout believer? You know, we should all respect his decision to nearly kill his child. I wonder if we should start asking questions about Isaac. For example, how did he feel watching his beloved father tie him up to the woodpile? What were his thoughts when his father reached for the knife? It's interesting in Rembrandt's depiction of the story that Abraham is covering Isaac's face. Why would he do that? Was it to spare him the sight of seeing his own father kill him or to silence him? After the incident was over, how might it have affected Isaac? Could he have suffered from PTSD? How might it have affected his family? And I have a number of other questions that, you know, I don't want to take time now to go through these, but these are some of the questions I think that faith communities could start asking and talking about. Again, these are some of the benefits I think that they could see if faith communities wanted to go beyond where they are now and talk openly about some of these issues instead of trying to sweep them under the rug or try to handle them internally, gag orders, you know, in cases go to court and that kind of thing. When a place of worship reaches out in this way, the ultimate win is that children will be regarded as individuals worthy of human rights. And my hope is that churches, synagogues, and mosques will perceive children in a more positive light and better attend to their physical and emotional needs. Thank you. And I know we've got like a Q&A time tomorrow morning. Do you 5 minutes or something for some questions now, or? Okay. So 10 minutes for questions.
You mentioned Mitzitsa Bet Pa, and there were 3 deaths this year from that procedure. And yet, getting back to taking a look at the victim's perspective, over 150 little babies die every year from circumcision, but you didn't mention that as the general abuse, and I'm sure you're aware that that never would have entered our society without religious influence. It was done to stop masturbation in the United States, which was definitely from puritanical religious teaching. So I'd like you to comment on the systematic sexual torture and abuse that is exercised against children with religion in some cases. As a justification.
Yeah. You wanted me to comment on male and female genital cutting? Is that the question?
Yeah, children's perspective on being tortured and sexually abused as a child in that manner.
Okay. When I look at definitions of abuse and neglect, I pretty much go with pretty much. I wouldn't say I agree with 100%, but how prosecutors define abuse and neglect. I don't consider cutting away children's genitalia to be sexual abuse because I look at it differently. But I do have a chapter in my book on the issue of genital cutting of children. And this is a issue that is so difficult for people in the cultures where they're happening to have a rational discussion about. This is true in countries that are cutting girls, and it's true in the United States that does most of the male cutting. And I research this really thoroughly. It's all in the chapter on my book, but I do think it's really important that when we look at any form of maltreatment or even trying to consider whether it is maltreatment, that we all kind of get on the same playing field about and the same page to understand what is abuse and what is neglect. I don't consider there shouldn't be any kind of exemption for certain kids than other kids, whether it's caused because of religious belief, cultural rich, traditions or whatever. If we are going to say that cutting a child, that hitting a child, any of these kinds of actions are abuse, then they're abuse. It doesn't matter what the motivation of the perpetrator is. Now, if there's some surgical procedure that's done that is medically necessary, and a doctor deems it to be medically necessary, of course that's a different thing. We as parents have to make decisions about children when we can't consult with them because they're babies or they're toddlers or young children. This is an issue we really need to talk about more and just try to look at how we define abuse and neglect and just for a minute, just put all the religious types of justifications off to the side.
I'd like to ask a little bit more about, if you could elaborate, about the psychological effects of religious education. Maybe more so about how it pertains to being raised in a Mormon upbringing. I have horrific memories of growing up in Sunday school and learning about a Heavenly Father who, all throughout the Old Testament, committed wars against his people. And I think a prime example that you illustrated was Isaac and Abraham. But what psychological effect do these stories have on children's religious education?
Well, I wasn't raised with much religion at all, but I do specifically remember, and I will answer the question, but I just find that this is kind of interesting that the little glimpse of religion I had, which was being taken to a synagogue by family friends, and it was the Passover service, and the kids all went through that downstairs in the basement while the adults had their service. And I'm like 10 years old, and I've not been indoctrinated in any of this stuff, right? So I'm just hearing the rabbi. I remember he had this elderly guy, this big temple in Cincinnati, and he had these bags under his eyes. He was a scraggly old kind of like, who was it that did the Great Imitation last night? The guy that was like growling in his throat. I mean, this guy he never once smiled. He never seemed to really take any joy in teaching the children his faith. But, he's talking about the angel of death flying over the houses and the firstborn are getting slaughtered. And I just knew as a kid that didn't sound right. And I mean, violence is violence. I knew what violence was. Fortunately, I hadn't been fed that from day one and been have that shoved down my throat and been made to feel like that was the norm and that my natural instincts weren't getting suppressed and made to feel like, you accept this as good and normal. But back to your question. When you're talking about religious education, indoctrination, and those kinds of things, it's so difficult because it's so subtle and ongoing. It's so difficult to actually recognize it as abuse. If you have, say, really severe spurning and terrorizing, that's pretty easy to spot, I think. But until I realized that, until I understood what exploiting was, I didn't quite get it myself. But again, exploiting is a form of emotional abuse. And if you see it in a religious context, that is, when children are being indoctrinated, they are being taught and forced to believe a very narrow worldview, like killing a whole bunch of babies is a good thing, and things like that, then it is exploiting and therefore abusive. I mean, that's really how I look at it.
Okay, so I think it's interesting the idea that you are, I mean, I applaud that idea to help educate religious faiths, like, to not have this occur. I mean, I get that. However, part of me is like, but I want people to leave their organized religion. Like, I want children to see the disconnect with our technology and stuff that's happening in the LDS faith. They see it, and they're not buying into it. The credibility of the leadership is diminished because of the things they do versus what kids are seeing. So I guess I just wonder if aiding groups helps perpetuate religion, because religion ultimately is an authoritarian type thing, because you're deferring to somebody else's idea of what your relationship should or shouldn't be with God or humankind. I don't know, I'm just a little torn, so
yeah,
if you talk about that.
I appreciate that question a lot. Well, first of all, I do think it's really important to recognize religious communities that are authoritarian and which ones are not very authoritarian. I mean, you're not going to find cases of religious child maltreatment in liberal, progressive, left of moderate churches, synagogues, and mosques. You're just not going to, you may still find abuse and neglect. I think you'll be hard pressed to find cases where they're being religiously justified. So if it brings you any solace, we're trying to empower the good guys. I understand your feeling that, well, you know, wouldn't we all be better off if there just wasn't any religion? Wouldn't that be the most helpful thing to children? And then we would not be facing this. I think we have to be realistic to accept that, I don't know, it's like, you know, the human condition to want to believe in something supernatural, to believe, to be part of some sort of community. And so many communities in America are bonded through religious belief and God worship. So I guess I will say we do put on conferences that talk about these issues to the general public. So it's not like we're only kind of operating behind the scenes. I think what's most important is that we're educating people in the outer communities, in the general public, about religious child maltreatment, and that we are trying to promote the faith communities that care enough to learn about this and make changes. This isn't just us going in there and saying, well, let's have a good talk about this, you know, see ya. They have to abide by, pass a resolution to say they agree with our charter for child-friendly faith, which gives parents' autonomy and children's rights and that kind of thing. They have to come up with their own program that shows how they're benefiting children, and they have to go through quite a rigorous series of steps to get to the point where they're designated child-friendly faith community. So it is pretty tough for them to do that. And I think what's going to happen is, you know, mostly the more progressive communities will do that. But then what I see happening, I guess, my vision anyway, is that more and more of these less authoritarian communities will get on board, and it'll start more of a movement where the more conservative ones will see that, well, if we want to be part of this, we have to make some changes.
Can I ask her just one question? I'm curious what your thoughts are about the baptism at 8 years of age in the Mormon Church and all that kind of comes along with that and what that does to an 8-year-old's mm-hmm. mentality in terms of their development.
Well, I didn't grow up in the church, so it, you know, I'm just going by what people have told me about their experiences being baptized as a child. And, you know, I've never heard anyone talk to me about it in a way that made it sound great and fun. It was always basically, you know, going along with what was happening. And I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of build up to it. And then when it happens, I think, you know, because this is something that children, it's often not communicated to a child in a way that he or she can fully comprehend. And also this idea, and so many religions do this, you know, setting an age as being this, you know, big momentous point in their life when all of a sudden they're going to get it is just a sign of not understanding how child development works. So, you know, the whole idea of having children be in this, you know, kind of template fashion of child rearing, it really comes from a place of ignorance. And, you know, I think that once if there are religious organizations, and there are some that really do understand child development more, that have child psychologists be, you know, part of working with them and developing their programs and that kind of thing, you're not going to see those kinds of, you know, cookie cutter type of decisions when it comes to child rearing. Hope I've answered that to your satisfaction.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.